afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here live with you every Tuesday at 2 p.m. talking to you about healthcare, fitness trends, taking your phone calls. Today's show is kind of an interesting way to start the new year. I have with me today Rebecca Latimer, who is author of the book You're Not Old Until You're 90, Best to Be Prepared, however. And we'll be talking about what it's like, actually, to live graciously into a mature and elderly age, or what, I don't know what we want to call this, but to live really well into your 80s and into your 90s. What is that like? As usual, I'll open up the phone lines for your participation probably around 2:40. And the number for that, whether you're in this area code or another, is 510-848-4425. And I'll give that number out when we get ready to take your calls. I just very briefly wanted to say something before we get into the show. You know, this business of the new year and people making resolutions to change themselves. You know, people get sort of a bug in the new year to do this. One of the things that happens is that people begin to exercise, and sometimes for the first time here in the new year. Now, there's a kind of catch-22 in this situation. So I just want to sort of tether you, not uncomfortably. I want you to go ahead and start to exercise. But winter is a time when your body really does best maintaining and resting and restoring itself, just like the ground does during the winter. People who exercise all the time understand this as something we call periodization in training or exercise. That means that different seasons are appropriate and best for different types of training. So if you're new to exercise, what you need to remember is that when you begin something new, you not only need to begin where you are instead of where you imagine you ought to be, you need to start slowly and give your body a chance to improve and train. But in addition to that, you need to remember that there's less light right now, that it's colder right now, that there are flu bugs around right now, and that your body needs to balance rest with exercise. And particularly during the winter, your recovery may be a little bit slower. Now, this is not to discourage you, because exercise will boost your metabolism, which will help with the fact that there's less light out there. It'll make your metabolism buzz along instead of slowing down in the darkness. But you must be sort of gentle with yourself and sort of appreciate the fact that the winter is a time of restoration. So whatever you begin when you're starting new, be really attentive to your energy level and rest when you're tired. Be consistent, but maybe even start at a lower level than you imagine and be consistent with it. And we're going to talk about the benefits of what happens when you discipline your body and your mind in this way in this show. For people who may want to get a tape of today's show or any other in this series, you can always call me if you need to reach me during normal business hours at 707-769-1458. And as usual, I'll give this number out again at the end of the show. Let me introduce my guest, Rebecca Latimer, and welcome her from Sonoma here. She came over to be with us in person. Thank you for coming.
I'm glad to be here.
Yes. Briefly, Rebecca, for 25 years, traveled the world as the wife of a career foreign service officer, and she kept diaries and wrote about her experiences, and really it was only after her husband's retirement in 54 that she was able to let some of this material out. There was a kind of censor thing that went on with the published material that she was writing. Her work has been published in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, House and Garden, and Western Humanities Review. She's also published a children's book titled Susie and Layla, Teenagers in Turkey, where they lived in Turkey in the Foreign Service. Rebecca's journals, letters, manuscripts, and other papers have all been preserved for future housing in the permanent Rebecca Latimer Special Collection at Mills College, at Mills College Library in Oakland, California, here in the East Bay. Born in September of 1905, this vivacious woman spent a lifetime learning how to live life to its fullest. The relevance of her ideas and practical advice on aging and vigor is convincingly shown by the fact that she finished this book at age 91. Her spunk and enthusiasm undiminished over the years. Remember, she says, it's your body that's aging, not you, she says. I'd rather be over 70 than under 50. Rebecca has been married to her husband, Fred, for nearly 70 years and lives in Sonoma, California. Again, it was so nice to have you come in person.
Well, it's fun.
By the good graces of your generous son who came over and fetched you and brought you here. You know, it's interesting to do the show now because one of the movements in health is something that we call life extension. So there's all of these supplements and hormones and all this new stuff trying to help us to learn to live longer lives, which you already managed to do. You know, my main question for you, Rebecca, is have you always been so optimistic?
No. No, when I was in the Foreign Service, I can't remember how many times, I wouldn't like to remember, that I often said to myself, I'd rather be dead.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the place for me, the Foreign Service. But now I've discovered that life is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. I can do what I want. It took a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I began when I was about 60. That's where the book really begins. And I went to the authorities, as I thought they were, to find out what I should do to learn to, how to live. I didn't really know. The first thing I found out was that I had to meditate. I didn't even know the word. I didn't know a single person who meditated.
Well, the thing that I found very moving is that you talked about encountering literature that discussed the concept of waking up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you suddenly realized that, in fact, you hadn't been awake, which was the first revelation, was, oh. It's interesting to read this book partially from my perspective because your children's generation and my generation, the baby boomers, encountered the same sort of literature at the same time, you at 60, us as young people. And what happened is that many of us took very much to heart the things that we learned, and we sort of threw ourselves into these yogic practices and meditation and all these various disciplines, and in many cases pushed ourselves so hard that we kind of bullied ourselves. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about what your understanding is of the difference between disciplining yourself and learning to participate in the process of being alive and being awake without forcing or pushing to the point of being detrimental.
Well, I don't think that's a very interesting question. I don't think I ever forced myself to that was detrimental. Actually, I just discovered that I was learning self-discipline mostly by feeling that I had to do these things. I had to meditate. I had to be aware. That's what not being asleep is really. Mindfulness, you know, it's a big thing now. Mindfulness is being aware, and that is when you've waked up, if you know what's going on around you. If you know what you're thinking yourself or what you're doing yourself, a lot of people don't even notice not what's going around them, but they don't notice what they are thinking or what they even want to do.
Exactly.
Yeah, they live half asleep.
So part of what we're saying here is that you made this discovery, this concept of being awake, and what I understood in your book is that you took the route of including silence in your life.
Oh,
some
you have
silence.
To. Mm-hmm. Oh, you have to. Otherwise, how do you? You don't know what's going on if you don't stop and listen. And you have to listen to yourself as well as what's going on.
One of the things that people say to me a lot is that they know what to do and they don't do it. You know, there's a sort of question of why can't they discipline themselves? And I think that part of what happened in this 40-year or 50-year gap between us, in my case, I guess about 44 years, is that women's lives have changed remarkably, and also the world has changed remarkably since you were my age. We're very crowded right now, and everybody is working, so people are exhausted. You kind of came to meditation and discipline in a kind of quieter way, and I think the dilemma for people now is that the pace of life has changed so remarkably that they're exhausted. So what do you say to people who feel like, oh, you're asking me to do more?
You're not going to like this. I think it's their fault. I think nowadays, I'm ashamed of this because my mentor, Emily Rockwood, who's in the book as my role model, never once said, what is the world coming to? But I really have to say that I think now people think more of their pleasures. They think of their pleasures as necessities. They have to have two cars. They have to have a boat. They would love to have a helicopter. They want so much. All right, so they both have to work. Two in a family have to work. That wasn't true when I was growing up. And I think there are a lot of things that are bad about that, but we needn't go into that now. But I do think that it's the fault of the people. I've gotten a lot of letters since this book came out. It hasn't been out long, but I've gotten about 50 letters. Of them, many of them say, I can't find 15 minutes a day to be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I write back to them, you've got to, mm-hmm. or you won't get anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's confusion. I think that what you're talking about, if I understand, first of all, I don't dislike what you said. I agree with you up to a point. I mean, I think there's terrible poverty in this country, and I don't think we can say that about people who are impoverished.
No.
But we can say that it isn't necessarily a big movement, but there's a movement among people to simplify their lives. Not a big movement because people are buying bigger cars, among other things, but to simplify their lives and have priorities. And what you're saying is, your discipline grew out of a sense of prioritizing mm-hmm. what was important. And to you, the primary focus was to become awake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that you say in the book is you talk about controlling mind and body, and you talk about mind and body and I being separated. I have to tell you that I do feel that I am my body. I don't feel that I'm separate from my body. I think that mind, body, and I are connected and that there's a unity there. But one of the things that's interesting here is that when I was reading your book and you were talking about controlling and discipline, I kind of felt this sense of pulling back because for me, I didn't experience it as discipline. I experienced it as moving in an inclination towards something that felt right. It was a felt feeling. But in fact, when I review my life, there's an extraordinary amount of discipline in it. It's just mm-hmm. that I've forgotten that I use discipline.
Yes. We all have to use discipline if we get anywhere.
So talk about this issue of, I mean, in order to find the sort of inner wisdom that you found, you did visualizations. Talk about some of the practices that you think were the most transformative for you.
Well, I think meditation, of course, the first thing, absolutely the first. I do a lot of relaxation, which also takes in visualization. Having trouble with my eyes, I do visualization on them. And those are the two things that I do every day regularly. And I don't think I can ever give that up. A couple of times when there have been crises, I felt I haven't time to do this. And then I knew I did. I had to do it. And that's really the two serious things. Oh, I don't know. I would like to say something that you haven't asked me.
Of course, go ahead.
I would like to say that doing this, getting this discipline, learning to meditate, learning to relax, learning to look at life as it is, has given me a wonderful reward. Because here I am with all sorts of things going on around me. My husband has been very ill, that sort of thing. And somehow I can accept everything. I can accept everything I'm asked to do. And I'm not disturbed by it. I'm on an even keel. It's extraordinary. The reward is amazing. Besides that, I guess the other thing that I think is the reward is that at this point, I don't dislike anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
I was going to ask you about that. Mm-hmm.
I like everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody seems a person to me. And if they have their drawbacks, so do I. Who doesn't? I forgive anything. I don't ask even my grandchildren to write to me. A lot of them do, but I don't ask them to. I don't ask for much, and I'm really very fortunate.
And what you're saying is that this was a shift. This is not how you were.
Oh, enormous shift.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay,
and
so you were less magnanimous.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But I was less patient. I was. Mm-hmm. I didn't care about other people. I thought about myself. And when I thought, I wish I were dead, as I did so often, think what that means. That meant I wasn't thinking about anybody. I wasn't thinking about my husband or my children or anything. I just was thinking I didn't like the situation. I wanted to get out of it however I had to do it. That, how what a change that's been.
Very briefly, for those of you who may be just tuning in, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I am Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, and I'm live in the studio with Rebecca Latimer, who is author of the book You're Not Old Till You're 90, Best to Be Prepared, however. And we'll be going to about 2:40, and then we'll pick up your phone calls at 510-848-4425, but please wait until I tell you when we're going to open up the phone lines. Okay, so what happened is that you began to apply, you quietly began to uncover literature and things that encouraged you to begin to sort of view your life and your consciousness as a craft, to begin to have some practices, to begin to apply some discipline to whether you want to controlling or observing. You developed this quality of inner observation, which has given you some equanimity, some
That's
unperturbability.
Right. That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
You know, one of the things that also occurs to me is the importance of the fact that you always had something in your life that you were drawn to do, which is your writing. Not everybody is as lucky as you are in that sense of always being drawn to something. And I think, again, women's roles have changed dramatically. What do you make of this? How are you seeing the changes in the world? Because one of the things that's interesting to talk to you about, saying that you like being older, is that you've watched the world go through a tremendous amount of changes, and we're all just rushing around like rabbits. And, you know, one possible approach to this is, you say now that you don't feel as judgmental, you feel warmth toward people. One possible approach is to pull yourself away and to say, this is utter nonsense, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Can I say that on the air? I think I can. I just did. So for you, I don't get the sense from you that you're being that you're enforcing an artificial positive view on the world. I'm sensing that your attention may be somewhere else. But what kind of advice can you give to somebody who may be younger than you that is, as I said, at a loss? I'll let you sort of answer. I think you know what I'm after.
Because what I'd say was read my book. But actually, I think they have to realize that nobody's going to help them. They have to do this themselves. I don't think people realize that they're alone, that there's nobody in the world that's going to feel about you as you do yourself, not your doctor, not your husband, nobody. And so if you really want to live to the fullest, you've got to figure out how to do that. And mostly, partly it's being open. It's partly being ready to accept new ideas, to not be critical, to welcome new friends. I find one of my, I guess it's, what would you call it, methods, is not to entertain anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't give dinner parties anymore. I will never go to another cocktail party. Never, never, never. But I do a lot of asking people to the house for tea, usually one-on-one or two-on-one. And when you do that, then you can talk about real things. If you have a group, then it gets to be, have you seen the movie? Have you gone there? What are you doing tomorrow? That kind of thing. But if you have just one or two people, pretty soon they're telling you what's really troubling them. And you can really do something for them.
Okay, well, let's talk about that for a second, because one of the things you talk about is that when you finally began to feel compassion for other people, you noticed that it was important for you not to take their pain on so you wouldn't get overwhelmed. So let's talk about that for a second.
That's difficult. That's very difficult.
How do you do that, Rebecca? What kind of a practice do you do that helps you to do that?
It's simply being aware. Because, you know, we were taught that it was, I guess, feminine maybe, that you'd be sorry for people and to feel their pain. And that is not healthy. It's not healthy to feel a person's pain, and especially if you love them, because then you're distraught. You can't help them. So you have to learn to step back and feel for them, have compassion for them, but do what you can in a kind of a impersonal way almost.
Again, one of the things that's really clear from the book is that there was no magic in what happened. Even though you connected with something magical in yourself, there was nothing magic. You just did. I mean, there are, you know, Eastern religions and practices and all this. I mean, till they're blue in their face, they're saying things like, if you're going to do this thing, whether it's Qigong or yoga or meditation, you have to keep doing it. It isn't like you're going to. And of course, we live in this society where we're taking cold medications because God forbid that we should have a runny nose or something. We all want this sort of fix. And you're saying, forget the fix, fix yourself. And the first step is have some quiet time. One of the things about getting older that's difficult for people is this issue of not having the best health. And although you have very vigorous genetics, you've had a few sort of bad, you're shaking your head, you had a few nasty sort of things happen, and among them was your sort of thing with cancer on your face, the squamish cell. So why don't you talk a little bit about what happened when you, because it's a wonderful story, what happened when you suddenly were told you might have to have part of your nose removed?
That was really extraordinary. I'd already found in Utah, we were living, Fred, my husband was teaching at the university, that it was a high altitude and strong sun, that I had some cancer on my face. And I asked the doctor what we should do, and he said, well, we can have radiation or we can do it surgically. We have to remove it. Well, I thought surgery would leave a scar, and I thought radiation wouldn't. So I took radiation. It was a mistake. Because I don't think he knew, but I discovered afterwards, 20 years later, if you take radiation, it comes back. So it came back when I got to California. And so I went to a dermatologist, yes, it has to be taken out and it'd be done surgically, and it left 27 stitches, I think, on the left side of my nose. Very neat, very tidy, but still it was an unpleasant experience. And so when it came again, it was about 5 years later, on the other side of my nose, I went to the surgeon to ask for an appointment. I got one, and it was 6 weeks later. He couldn't give me one sooner, and I couldn't face the 6 weeks knowing this was ahead of me. And so I remembered I'd read about Carl Simonson in Texas, who used visualization with orthodox medical treatment for cancer. So I got out all the books I had on that, and I was very fortunate, found just exactly what I needed. And so I did it, and I had the 6 weeks. It was an extraordinary experience. I went inside my nose. It was a beautiful thing. It looked like alabaster. Well, anyway, it worked. I didn't have faith in it. I didn't believe it was going to work. And the creatures, or whatever we want to call them, the helpers that I had, also wondered if it would work. And we all decided, at the end, that if it was, the surgeon said it wasn't as bad as he thought, we'd be pleased. But what happened was that when they took the first sample, they didn't find any cancer at all. It was gone.
And what's interesting about this is that the diagnosis was squamish cell or squeamish cell.
Squamish.
Squamish. I always think squeamish because and that's how I feel about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's very serious. And they were talking about the possibility of removing a great big bit of your nose.
Grafting, too.
What you did was you didn't say, I can stop this cancer. You just said, well, I've got 6 weeks, and I've been doing visualization, so let me see if I can do some visualization. Yeah. Couldn't hurt.
Yeah.
And there you were without, and it hasn't reoccurred.
No.
It's remarkable, really.
It is.
It's a real, it really speaks to this idea of visualization.
It does.
You've been married for almost 70 years.
It'll be 69 in February.
And although, as we've been saying, you haven't had perfect health, your husband has had more trouble. And my impression is from reading the book that you've not been able to pull him into your camp. As far
no,
as
you can't do that. Mm-hmm. I have friends who have already started on this path, and they can't get their partners to do it either. And my first man was Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff said, you mustn't even try. You must let people come to it on their own. There's no use telling them, I found this magic thing. This is going to help me. It will help you. There's no use, he said. They've got to come to it on their own. This is a very bitter thing, because if you love someone and you see that this is, well, for instance, one of the things that this has helped me is to put pain at a distance and to have the feeling that pain is perhaps a healthy element rather than something to be afraid of. I wouldn't avoid anything that was painful simply because it was painful. And yet, if someone you love is suffering, You want to help them get into that state that it isn't so awful, that they can handle it. And you can't do it.
Well, and the other problem with all of this is that people are so distinctly different from each other. It's so astonishing how much they're different
from
each other.
Yes, but look at all the different people that are different from you and me who still go on this path.
Yes.
It doesn't take... They're not the same people. Anybody could do it. But you have to be... I think you have to be in the spot, the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that probably, as you're beginning to get older, is a good time to get into this.
Get a grip.
Yeah.
To get a grip of it. Well, and as I said, I think some of us got a grip when we were younger and then maybe did it in a... You know, maybe the advantage to coming to this later in life is that you are, by the very nature of who you are, slower and more deliberate when you get older. And when you're young, if you sort of run at a brick wall, you go, wow, you know, I don't like the way that felt. I think I'll, you know, and so it's almost like you have to say, no, look, I ran at the brick wall, it didn't do me any good, and now I have to review what I've done. So, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about reading how your path came to be was that it came about in a kind of quietude and in a kind of quiet, deliberate way, which is different than what a lot of people do when they start something new. They sort of...
Of course. Rush at it.
Yes.
But that's one of the advantages of getting older. In fact, when you get to be as old as me, there are lots of advantages in that you're not so busy, you're not so pressed, you have more choices. I can do a lot of things that my sons can't do because they have businesses they have
to go
to.
You have time. You have time.
I'm really lucky.
Yeah, time is
like
the biggest gift.
And as for the writing part, of course, there are people who are musicians, there are people who are artists. I have a lot of friends among those people. But they're the lucky ones. I just don't know. Well, I just think it makes it easier if you have something you want to do. For instance, I'm living alone, and this is new to me, but I'm not lonely. I always have something I want to do, to get out to my workroom and work if I can.
Yes.
I'm really fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we're almost ready to take a brief musical break. And what we'll do is when we come back, we'll continue this interview for a few more minutes, and then we'll open up the phone lines. This is Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness, on the air with Rebecca Latimer, author of You're Not Old Until You're 90, Best to Be Prepared. However, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
Bottle of wine, it might be down till 2:45. Would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman. I'm live in the studio with Rebecca Latimer, author of You're Not Old Till You're 90, Best to Be Prepared, however. This book is published by Blue Dolphin Press, which actually has an 800 number. If you have trouble finding the book, you can call them by calling your 800 directory and getting their number. Blue Dolphin Press is... Nevada City. So we're going to talk a little longer, and then we'll open up the phone lines. When we do, the number is 510-848-4425. Please don't call yet. We're going to be talking just a little bit longer, and we want to give everybody a chance to call in. You just talked about living alone and having, you know, one of the ways that people are different is in terms of their, for instance, desire or capacity for solitude versus intimacy. And... you know, how comfortable they are with that. The other thing is that I've noticed that what you don't do, which is very interesting, is I've been told that at a certain age, we begin to remember our early 20s, our early part of our life, more clearly than anything else. Our short-term memory's gone, but boy, what you did when you were 19 and 20 is right there. And I've noticed that you're very, probably because of the practice you've been doing, you're very much in the present. You don't talk about, well, when I was 20, you know, and they're going... So is it the case that you have less of that experience? Do you experience yourself more in the present than being washed over with memories?
Well, I must tell you, I am now experiencing in my early days because I'm writing a book about it.
Oh.
The Feminist Press has asked for my autobiography.
Great.
They want to begin at the beginning. So I've forgotten a lot of it. I didn't hold it with me. One of the things I feel very strongly about is that when we're grown, we can still be... hurt by what we learn from our parents. And we should know that once we're grown, we are our own masters. We don't have to carry that burden. And I think that's why I've forgotten my childhood, which was not a happy one. Now that
Well, but you also don't seem to dwell on your early life.
No.
As I was saying about people's differences in terms of being able to live alone or not live alone, one of the things that's frightening for people as they age in the concept of living alone is either that they will have dug in their heels about being on their own and then become terribly isolated, or that they won't really know how to take care of themselves and that they're vulnerable. And that, I think, is one of the things that frightens people about living alone as they age.
I don't know. I don't feel that way, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I have more friends now than I did, say, 15 years ago. The telephone rings all the time. And, of course, I'm happy when it doesn't, so I can work. In fact, I often go out to my workroom without taking the telephone. I feel guilty about that.
Actually, you do. You know, it's interesting, as you're talking about your solitude and what it means to you, how rich an inner life you had. And it suddenly struck me that you look ever so slightly like Katharine Hepburn, who is another... you do. You have a very slight resemblance to her. And she's another indomitable woman who is a tremendous role model for women in my generation because, you know, she really basically never married even.
No.
Did you like being married?
I think I would say no because when you're in the Foreign Service, the wife is simply to support the husband. And you can't do anything on your own. You have to do everything that helps his career. And if you know the wrong people or ask them to the house, it hurts his efficiency report. Maybe it's not true now. That was a long time ago. But I really felt that. You know, it was difficult not being able to try to publish and so forth. But then, of course, I got the journals. And that was a big help later on for the material.
You mentioned at the end of the book you discuss your relationship to the concept of death and the feelings about death and stuff, and what sort of strengthened your resolve and made you feel less afraid is the fact that many, many people have reported experiences, near-death experiences, that for you mean that there must be some kind of afterlife.
Oh, I feel sure of that.
Okay.
And I feel sure there's going to be better than here. I feel sure, at least I hope I'll get more challenge than I've been given here. And I hope if I come back, I'll do better.
One of the near-death experiences that you reported was that people who had strokes, that you knew people other than your husband who had strokes, who reported this experience of near-death and came back. Did your husband ever have an experience where he had...
No, and he won't talk about death. For a long time now, I've been trying, when we have people into tea, I can somehow bring this subject up in a way, you know. I've been reading this interesting thing about life after death and so forth, and he's never shown me how he feels about it or anything. It troubles me a great deal.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know whether I'll change my mind as I get older. For now, I don't believe in life after death. I think that maybe part of what may happen when people are having that experience at the end is that there's a kind of ecstasy. It's like being born in a certain way to let go, to have the... And for me, it's always been a question of... learning to let go in life, that my practice, you know, whatever spiritual or disciplines, were intended to make me, like you, feel more magnanimous and to accept whatever was happening. So to me it made, I have to say that this is just me, but I don't find it frightening to think that we don't continue. I mean,
I still feel frightening, because we don't know, do we?
We don't know.
I'm not a bit frightened. Mm-hmm. Whatever happens,
okay,
happens.
Okay, that's what I wonder.
But the way I feel is it would be a terrible waste, because... We all have learned something in this life, I hope. And I just think that it'd be a pity if we can't use it and improve and do more. I think that'd be a shame.
It would be
and
a shame.
And I also believe this is an ordered universe, that there's a point to it all that we can't see because of our small brains. And that, after all, it's the universe is better than we are.
Oh, I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
I can't argue with that. We're terribly perverse animals.
That's why I really like to think anyway. It doesn't matter what we think.
It really doesn't.
It's going to happen.
It really doesn't matter what will happen. And you are correct in saying that, you know, many of the most respected religious practices and religions, some of the older ones like Buddhism as well, believe that, you know, you do all this work, there has to be some purpose to the work. And that's, yeah, certainly could be.
Yeah.
Anything could be. But
anything,
I wondered whether it mattered one way or the other.
When you think about all the miracles, there are all kinds of miracles going on. And when we talk about luck, half the time I think that can't be luck. That this, like this book taking off. I just can't believe it. I said at first, I'm lucky. I do say that because it sounds modest. But actually, I think something else that this change in the world, that the people are picking up on this book. I never thought anybody would be interested in it. There are innumerable people. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I don't know about luck. Yeah, I think that things happen for a reason.
Of course,
but,
Carl Jung didn't believe in luck, but he called it synchronicity or something or other. Anyway.
It's true. I mean, there's no matter what you do, it's going to create a ripple.
Yeah,
anything you do,
true.
Good or bad,
that's
is going to create a ripple effect
that's
in the universe. Were you ever attempted to study with a teacher or study with a group?
I've never meditated in a group.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yesterday I did for the first time, I should say that.
Did you?
It was just that we were a group discussing old age, and at the end they had a meditation. No, I never have. Yes, I would like to. But
how did you like sitting, meditating with a group of people? How did you like that
experience? It was very short. It was, and I don't think most of them were with it. I didn't look to see, because I enjoyed it. But the real thing is, with my husband's illness, you see, I couldn't leave home very much, and most of the time I didn't know anybody else was doing this.
Mm.
It was a long time before I knew anybody else who meditated.
There's
strange,
a lot of us around. A lot of us around.
Well, I was just lucky. No, I won't say I was lucky. It happened.
Well, luck, I mean, I, you know, I'm saying more about my own feelings than I usually do on the show, but my own sense of it is that opportunities are sort of floating around us all the time, and it really depends on how we're concentrating our focus or our presence, whether or not we take it advantage of things.
Yeah.
But there are always these opportunities around, you know.
And in every way, I mean, things to do, people to know, opportunities to take, there are all kinds of things. It doesn't matter how old you are.
I think the most compelling thing about your book is this idea of not just sort of saying, well, I don't need to change anymore. I'm an old person now. And I've always had a very strong feeling that we should reinvent ourselves constantly throughout life, you know?
Yes, but I think with me, it wasn't conscious. It just happened. And even now, I can see that I'm changing. But it's mostly because now I'm discussing these things with people. They give me new ideas. I can see, oh, maybe that idea I had wasn't correct. But it's sort of unconscious. I'm not saying to myself, I must change.
Well, what is conscious is a commitment to letting go of things moving on.
Letting go and being open.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of which, some impatient callers have already started ringing us up. So I'd like to request, to hear the callers, you'll need to put those on. The number to call in is 510-848-4425. Again, 510-848-4425, no matter what area code you're in. Please just hang tight. You'll hear a ringing, and that means you're getting through. I'd like to also request that if people call in regularly, to give other people a chance, because we do have people calling from all over, and remember to turn your radio down. Can we... Paul, are you not the same Paul that calls every week?
Hello?
Paul, are you the same Paul that calls every week?
But not every week. Huh?
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and then...
I call, so I wouldn't do it every week.
Okay.
Well, I was curious what you... you said Katharine Hepburn wasn't married. What's the idea? What's your idea of marriage that you said that she wasn't?
She didn't marry Spencer Tracy. He was married to someone else.
It wasn't legal, but
He was married to someone else.
But it wasn't, the other thing wasn't much of a marriage, and I thought, it wasn't much of a relationship, and I thought his relationship with Katharine Hepburn was a very close and sustained one.
And your question is?
So, when you said they weren't married, you just meant legally?
Is that all you wanted to ask, Paul?
Yeah, well, the idea of marriage is, or what the concept of marriage is.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Okay.
What is your concept of marriage, Rebecca?
Oh, I guess loyalty and help, supporting one another, loving one another. Of course, love is the thing that's most important of all in every aspect of life.
Let's move on to Melissa. Melissa? Yeah, hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You know, listen to you, Rebecca, you sound like such a beautiful soul. And I know I can't see you, of course, because you're on the radio, but it seems like you probably would have a soft light surrounding you. You just seem like a very beautiful person, and you have you give me great hope. I'm 27 years old, and a lot of the things that you're speaking of, I feel very deeply in my heart. And I realize that the challenge in life is to love and to forgive, which is really hard to do sometimes when people can be very negative. And it seems as if when you do, you are living in this way, it frightens people, and sometimes they react to you in a negative way. Have you experienced this from people before? And if you have, how is it that you react back to them?
I do think that people react in a negative way, in many ways that are really foolish. That I think it's a jealousy, maybe. You're happy and they're not, perhaps. I don't know.
Right.
But I think what I try to do is to see what makes them that way. I mean, why they feel inadequate and why they're treating me that way. There's a book by Laura Huxley, You're Not the Target. And that's one thing it's the title that sells the book for me, because lots of times people treat us in a way, they're not really treating us. They're treating some of the thing that happened, or some other person that was mean to them or something, and they take it out on us.
Of course.
So just try to understand.
Well, thank you, and it was a pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks,
thank
Melissa.
You. Thank you.
You know what I didn't ask you about is, you don't... If you have sort of what we might call negative feelings, my sense of you is that you have a very strong inner advisor inside you.
Oh, yes,
strong,
I do.
Yeah,
yes.
Sort of. You have your inner doctor.
Yeah,
yes. But you developed an observer inside. So my sense of you is that you don't make a big distinction between this is nice and this is not nice. You observe. Is that true?
Or? No, not always. I have to watch the negative aspect.
What does that mean for you to watch the negative?
To make sure that I don't just automatically say this is a bad situation, or this is an ugly person or something.
So, in other words, if you have something that might not be a positive feeling, you try not to be dismissive.
Yeah.
But what if it's a personal feeling? What if it has nothing to do with someone else? What if you have a feeling that feels darker? Are you accepting of that?
Well, you know, you were saying I had this, not an observer, but an advisor interior, and I put on my night table a thing you said the other day, you can control your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. But is that... By controlling your thoughts, does that mean that you then don't give light to the dark parts? Does that mean that you then don't have the fullness? Because some people find that the negative, so-called negative, aspects of who they are actually informative in terms of knowing what you need,
in terms of your
preferences.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Sometimes you don't know until you find out that you're upset with something.
Yeah. No, I think we're talking about different things.
Ah.
I think what I'm talking about is out there. And not in here.
Yeah, but the internal stuff.
The internal, I have to know it all.
You have to know it all.
You have to
I agree.
Recognize it.
Yeah, I vote for that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, there was a little thing in the book somewhere about the poor little lady that was crying. It was me. And I said to myself, I better check into that. She's crying.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Must listen. Let's move on to David in Berkeley.
Hi, I'll take the answer off the air. I'm wondering how you got to the place where you felt that you wished you were dead. And what was the turning point when you no longer thought that way? Thank you.
Thanks, David.
It was mostly not being able to be myself, not to say what I thought, not to meet people that I liked, a completely artificial life. I think it was before I had my children. I think it turned off after, it was a long time before I realized I wasn't thinking that anymore. But I think it was probably when I got in this path, maybe earlier.
My sense of with myself and with other people I've talked to is that sometimes when we feel lonely, we're estranged from ourselves, in fact. And sometimes when we feel like dying, we're losing some part of ourselves that's painful to let go of.
Mm-hmm.
And when we finally get through that tunnel, it lightens up.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, some estrangement from something.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's move on to Catherine in San Francisco.
Yes, hello. I'm glad the conversation has turned to death and wishing we were dead, that sort of thing. I went through a lot of that when I was younger, had a lot of difficulties. I'm 60, and I do have a job, although I don't make very much money. And I wasn't able to work a lot of the time in my younger days. So anyway, what I'm concerned with is I have a lot of apprehension. For as I get older, I mean, I'm happier now than I've ever been when I was young. But in the best scenario, I might be able to work another 10 years. But I'm reasonably healthy. I think, I would probably live longer than that. However, I'm not going to have any financial. Mm-hmm. I think your guest has money. And I and a lot of people like me, I don't think can look forward to pensions and various things like that in our old age. And so I just, it's like a yawning void. I would see no alternative but to end my life at a certain point when I could no longer maintain myself. So I would like your guest to address that.
Thank you for asking that question. That was something I was going to ask her, but
I'm
you asked it. You asked it very eloquently. Thank you.
Well, first, I'm going to talk about your predicament. I don't think you'll ever get to that point. Even though perhaps you can't find a job that pays, you may be able to. You may be able to find a volunteer job. You may be able to find someone to help you. But what I think is you shouldn't worry about it. You shouldn't be concerned about it. That you will find as you go along, things open up. And as for my own personal situation, my husband gets a pension. We went into the Foreign Service in 1929. He was paid a salary of $2,500 a year. Think about that. His pension, we got 25 years later, was based on that kind of money. We do not have a large pension. When he goes, and he's had three strokes, he probably will go before I won't be left with a great deal. I don't worry about that. I'll have Social Security.
Well, you also
I just trust.
Yeah, well, you also have sort of interesting things popping up, like, I think I'll write a book, and you wrote a book, and now you have a response, and you may be writing more books,
yeah,
so you
I
may be getting money.
Yeah, I don't expect to make money from the books.
Well, you will make
some
money.
I don't care, really.
No, I know, I know you don't care, but what I'm saying is, earlier in the book, you do say, plan.
Mm-hmm.
You say, sit down, take
That's
a piece
fine.
Of paper,
it's true.
Figure out what you
yeah.
want. So it isn't true that you don't think about this, you do. But
oh, you're
I think
right.
what you're
yes.
saying is that you try not to think about it with fear.
Yes, exactly.
You try to think of it creatively
perfectly.
Instead
yeah.
of with fear. And you try
perfectly.
To have some trust that
yeah.
you will continue to be this person
yeah.
with resources.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
Is that helpful?
And you maintain friendships. Yeah, she wanted to hear that off on the air, so she's gone.
Oh.
But we'll move on to Ira in Novato.
Good afternoon.
Yes, hi.
And it's raining in Novato.
It's raining everywhere, isn't it?
Well, that's a good title, too. Mm-hmm. I just want to say, first, I want to express our appreciation for having this wonderful woman on the air. And my wife, Greta, and I have been married over 60 years.
Oh, boy.
And we had recently our 80-60 party in our 80s, and celebrating. We'll be married in coming June, 61 years. So I think there's a certain degree of kinship there.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering how many of us are there around in the United States, let's say. Probably more than we realize. But then we met under different circumstances than you did with your husband. And we were raised during the Great Depression. And it was our social activism, organizationally, even in high school, that brought us together. And we found common ground that way. But, of course, as Catherine Hepburn once said, growing old ain't for sissies.
Mm-hmm.
Growing old is growing old. And... But the important thing is every day we have motivation and to be with people that are meaningful lives, too. And I think that's what's kept us going. And we're enjoying each other still. And I want to congratulate you on your book.
Thank you.
We will get it, certainly. But I just think it's very inspiring to be around this long. We have seen so many wars.
Yes.
Been in so many wars.
Yes.
And strikes we have been because we were industrial workers mm-hmm. for a while and so on. But every day we have something important.
Of course.
If I may say something, in as much as I hear him all the time, we have been actually social activists.
Good.
Social political activists, though we were professionals. I mean, I have taught, he has worked, and we have always had a lot to exchange and work for. But we've always worked things out together, and that's most important.
That's great.
Thank you so much for sharing yourselves with us. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah, so there's something about not sort of closing down and going away from the world. There's something
yeah.
about staying in the world.
Absolutely.
And the other thing is that, the other thing I feel very strongly in your book, and it's something I think about a lot too, which is that if you can slow down enough so that you, and this I do think is a gift of old age, if you can be conscious of it, is that you begin to enjoy just the experience of being alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have, you don't need a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to feel that you're present
mm-hmm.
and you're alive, and that can be very rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have another caller? No, we do not have another caller. We have open lines. That's unheard of. 510-848-4425 in the 510 area code, 848-4425, and there's a caller. And you know what? You don't have to screen this one. Just put this person through. Andrea, we did screen you. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead, please.
Hi. One of the things that I'm concerned of is I'm a flight attendant, and I'm older. I've been flying almost 37 years with American Airlines. And as I get older, I am becoming more invisible.
I was going to ask her about that, about the loss of your sexual self.
Right, and
yeah.
I, you know, I was hired for my look. I'm still attractive, but I'm not 20 years old. And as I get older, I am so frightened of being invisible. And I wondered if she could talk about that.
Andrea, is your sense, when you say you're frightened of being invisible, there's two different parts to this.
Yes.
The part that I was going to ask her about that I didn't is that women lose, to a certain degree, maybe it doesn't have to be this way, women lose their sexual identities
yes.
as they age. And that's sad because we're almost like the representative of all of everything about sexuality when we're younger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to lose that because there's a certain vitality in that. But you're talking about both. You're talking about also feeling like you fall through the cracks?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm talking more, I'm not so concerned about the male issue thing and being attractive to males. I'm really concerned about older people and the lack of visibility they get, and I'm just so aware of that. And I wondered if she could talk a little bit about that for me.
Well, I came across that quite early on. I guess I was probably 60 or 65.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when I was with younger people. And I discovered that they start talking about something and they just ignored me as if I wasn't in the room. And, I just didn't let it happen. I just spoke up. They were terribly surprised. They turned around and looked at me. And this went on for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once when I was staying, visiting my son and his wife, and she had some guests in. I've never forgotten this experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke a lot. And one of them came up to my daughter-in-law and said, "You know, your mother-in-law is an extraordinary person, isn't she? Really, she's wonderful." And my daughter-in-law, guess what she said? She said, "Yes, and she's mine."
Oh, thank you for sharing.
Oh, God. So now those of us that don't have children
know,
have to...
I don't
yeah.
have a child.
Yeah, I mean, we have to figure out. But, you know...
I really do get some of that from my young friends. Certainly,
mm-hmm.
I have friends who are 28, and I love them, you know. But I just the invisibility, like, for example, our magazines and
yeah.
the ads,
mm-hmm.
and when people on the airplane, you know, they look at you and they say, "I bet you've been here a long time, haven't you?" And they'll just come out and say that. Or the captain last trip I fly to Japan, he said, "God, your seniority number, Andrea." He said, "How old are you?"
Oh,
I mean, you should say,
being an airline hostess is rather difficult. I'm actually 27.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, we're just, you know what? We're all going to just have to blaze this trail. I mean, this is there's a large group of us going down this slope at the same time, this baby boom generation. So we're just going to have to leave a wide swath, you know, ahead of us. I think we won't be as invisible. I think this is the consciousness about this is raised,
mm-hmm.
and there's more of us around.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just going to have to work on this, Andrea. We're just going to have to speak up.
All right.
Okay, kiddo.
Bye
bye. Can we take one more quick caller? Yeah, let's get another caller on. Caller, are you with us?
Yes.
Go ahead, please, real quick.
Okay, my name is Lisa, and my question is about the visualization that you talked about for your cancer. And could you mention the name of the person, the books that you had been reading around that?
Yes, the book was by Carl Simonton, Simonton. He's a doctor in Texas. And he deals specifically with cancer. But there are a great many good books about visualization. I began with something called the Well Body Book, which I think is still around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they had some awfully good things on visualization. That's where I started. You might try it.
There are lots of books on visualization.
Mm-hmm.
There are also tapes available. There's a doctor in Mill Valley named Rossman, Rossman, Martin Rossman, and he has tapes available at his office on visualizations that he did with the scripture written with him and Naomi Remen. He's
well,
listed.
I just, because of my own history, the women in my family have been dying of cancer before 50 years old, and I'm now over 50, and I feel like every day I'm living on borrowed time, and I'm very happy, so I feel like whatever I can do to maintain my health and my happiness,
Yeah. Sounds like it's worth a try. I think Rebecca wanted to say one quick thing.
I just want to say one thing. Don't think like that. You'll bring it on yourself. For instance, my mother was blind when she was 70. I began having glaucoma when I was, 72, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not blind. I'm 92.
Right.
And I think if I'd gone around saying, oh, I'm going to be blind like my mother, I might have.
I thought that when I was under 46, and then at 46 was the year my mother died when she was 46.
You know what? We're completely out of time.
Oh.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, all of you who participated today. A reminder for those of you who may want to get a tape of today's show, or if you need to get hold of me during the week, you can always call me during normal business hours at 707-769-1458. Again, 707-769-1458. For a list of other available shows, send a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope to P.O. Box, with two stamps, please, P.O. Box 2714, 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Thanks to Jan Michaels for engineering today. Next week, I'll be back with Dr. Eric Braverman and Dr. Richard Schmeda, authors of two books, one about the therapeutic use of amino acids and the other on natural treatments of hypertension. Very important show. I'm Lena Berman. As always, this has been your own health and fitness talk show on KPFA and KPFK FM. See you next week.